So preparative arts work on a few different levels of really thinking through what knowledge is, how knowledge is cultivated, and which knowledges have been subjugated and intentionally erased, and how much of that knowledge is embodied.
Welcome to Groove and Griot, a podcast about how we use dance to tell stories. I'm Ara Olobadaki.
And I'm Ajane Truss. Let's get grooving.
On this episode of Groove and Griot, we talk with Dr. Jasmine Lynn Blanks-Jones, who is currently the executive director for the Center for Social Concern at Johns Hopkins University. She actually did this interview while holding her adorable newborn daughter. You probably heard her patting her on the back in the beginning opening clip.
Dr. Blanks-Jones, Ara, and I all met while pursuing our PhDs at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia, a place where Dr. Blanks-Jones has many important connections.
I'm from Philly, so it was really awesome to be there as a doc student a few years ago because I was born there but didn't really grow up there. Philadelphia is where I consider home, despite not having lived there for most of my childhood or my adult life. It's where I had a lot of my early experiences, it's like learning about being a Black woman. I was in an all-Black Girl Scout troop where we did African dance. And things that, when I just look at even that example, that cross the civic and political, because that's what scouting is all about, like patriotism and all that stuff. All right along with like womanhood or girlhood. And because we were in a Black community, all of those things melded. So Philadelphia is really important for me in terms of how I think about my identity.
We were all a part of the Collective for Advancing Multimodal Research Arts, or CAMRA. We started the CAMRA Archives podcast together, and Ara, as you know, this was where some of the ideas for Groove and Griot started to take shape.
Right. And on the first episode of the CAMRA Archives podcast was a recording of a panel that Dr. Blanks-Jones, myself, Dr. Deb Thomas, and Dr. Jasmine Johnson were on called What the Body Knows. We wanted to start off by coming back to a question that Dr. Blanks-Jones posed for that panel and seeing how her thinking has developed since posing the question years ago. Here's Ajane with the question.
It was the What the Body Knows panel, and there was a question that you asked, which was about how researching in and through the body creates possibilities for collective participatory knowledge creation differently from other forms of multimodal research. And I'm curious to hear what you would say to that question now.
I think with that question now, a couple of years later, I think about the Performing the Archive course that I teach and the Black Storytelling for Public Health course that I teach. And I think that that when we don't think about the body and the place of histories and archives, that a lot can easily be missed of the story. And it might not be that this is the story case in point and it's factual and this is everything that the archive says, because we're dealing with archives that are constructed without Black people in mind oftentimes. We're just beginning to create many of our own archives, community archival work, and things that really center Blackness in important ways. But when we are dealing with archives that have left out particular stories intentionally and because they just weren't considered important when we chose the materials that would become the archive, there's a lot of learning that can come about by thinking about which bodies interacted with materials and how those bodies interacted with them. So that's one piece that I think about a bit differently than I did when I originally posed the question.
Dr. Blanks-Jones goes on to describe a specific example from her work at Johns Hopkins, where she brought people together to think more intentionally about how bodies interacted with materials and the role of dance and storytelling in helping us to unpack the affective dimensions of this sort of work.
A lot of my thinking about reparative arts was shaped from a visit to the historic home that's on the campus at Johns Hopkins University, on the Homewood campus that was owned by the Carroll family. And when we visited that home, there was a sign on the wall that listed the names of the people who were enslaved. And the museum had begun steps towards telling the story of that home in ways that centered the Carroll family, yes, but also the two main families who were enslaved there, the Rosses and the Connors. But beyond telling those stories, there hadn't been anything done to recognize and celebrate their lives. And when I spoke with a lot of my colleagues who were part of the Inheritance Baltimore Project in that first year, they talked about there being this feeling of like heaviness and of just discomfort on the campus as Black people, as Black women in particular, that they couldn't shake. And they talked about that it wasn't like just them, but that they know people in the Baltimore area who just didn't like coming onto campus, so they didn't feel good being there. And Esther Ojeda writes about this, and she's an educationist. She writes about this experience on campuses that have a plantation history, that there's this feeling. And we don't talk a lot about feelings in academic work, not nearly enough. But there was this feeling that people were experiencing there, and it had a lot to do with spirituality and with the unsettled nature of knowing people's names and not dignifying their lives as full people, not just as slaves. And I'll say that intentionally because that placed them in a space of property. So yes, now stories are being told about people who were property, but beyond that, how had their lives been celebrated? So we held an event that I led called the Ritual of Remembrance in that first year, and that gave us a space to dance and to have African drumming, to actually, in line with this podcast, have some of the storytelling. We had a group come in that drew on the traditions of the griot traditions from the Senegalese culture. We had a jelly orchestra that incorporated not just African drumming with the talking drum, but stringed instruments that have a whole different meaning within the traditional ballets of the Senegalese culture that are for royalty. So how do we think about the Black people who were enslaved at Homewood, not just in the space of being property as slaves, but being the Black ancestors of Homewood and having a legacy that leaves an inheritance for Black people who step foot on that campus as a place where Black labor has created the conditions for Black students to now be able to learn there, and not as people who are lucky to have been accepted to an institution like Hopkins, but who are legacy. If we're going to think about that in the moment of CRT and who should be accepted and all of these other things, but without legacy, and I mean like elite white legacy students, they're not in jeopardy for their education experiences in this moment, but people of color are, first generation students are. How do we think about the role of Black labor in the building, in the maintenance of these spaces that constitute our academic halls, creating a legacy and an inheritance for Black students who would come to occupy those halls? And how do we create a space where when Black students in particular come to these campuses and learn about these really hard histories, and I lean into Dr. Martha Jones's work around hard histories there, she's also at Hopkins, when they learn about these hard histories, that it doesn't like hit them like a truck, but that we are telling these stories in a way that embraces them, that affirms their belonging in the academic institution that they've chosen to come to.
Throughout the series, we'll be taking what we're calling movement breaks, moments where we bring our personal movement practices into the podcast. For this break, we're sharing a clip from a lamban performance I was a part of last summer. Lamban is a dance done by the griots or jalis in the Senegambia region, and the music incorporates both the drums and the string instruments, of which the kora is the most famous that Dr. Blanche Jones was talking about.
Lamban can be a celebration dance, and it can also be a dance of healing and cleansing. Given Dr. Blanche Jones's call for embodied experiences that help us deal with the hard histories of the places we currently occupy, we felt this would be a relevant movement practice given the ideas she discusses.
Welcome back. We hope you enjoyed some Lamban rhythms. We'll get back to the interview with Dr. Blanks Jones.
So much of Dr. Blanks Jones' work around citizenship, public health, and community engagement falls under what she is calling reparative arts. We asked her to talk a little bit more about how she is thinking about embodiment within her conceptualization of reparative arts.
Inspired very much by Dorin Kondo's work in reparative creativity, where she talks about how a lot of theater making considers the dominant audience, which is middle-class white people. And even if theater work attempts to engage in serious thinking about race and racism, much of that work is softened so that the white audience members can go to dinner and feel good about themselves, even if they participate in racist acts from time to time. So Dorin's work focuses on the artists that are creating work that doesn't make it just easy to consume things that are harmful. I begin with Dorin and extend it because when I think about reparative arts in a scholarly way solely, I'm thinking about how the arts don't solely function as creativity, but as pedagogies, as processes and methods. I think a lot about how the arts can be used as research methodologies. In particular, I taught a course on performing the archive that thinks about how the body helps us to understand archival materials in a different way. It opens up new insights for us as researchers. And just even the arts, if you think about like arts and sciences, like the arts aren't always performance-based. They have a lot to do with disciplinary work and how we're approaching our epistemological traditions. So thinking about the arts as a source of knowledge making is mostly where I enter the conversation. The work around reparative arts for me comes off of a year and a half of a postdoctoral fellowship that I had at Johns Hopkins prior to stepping into my role at the Center for Social Concern. And I was an inaugural postdoctoral fellow of the Inheritance Baltimore Project, which is a catalyst for reparations for Black Baltimore through the humanities. And that for me was really the springboard into thinking about the reparative. If we're going to think about reparations and what it means to through the humanities, through history, for many of my colleagues, but for me through performance art in particular, how we're able to create spaces of repair that is largely an epistemological project if you're approaching it through the humanities. How do we reconstruct our thinking around how knowledge is, I would say, produced, with the caveat that even in that I've been challenged to think about when bodies are like coming together in artistic endeavors, it isn't necessarily a production of knowledge as much as a cultivation of knowledge and a co-cultivation of it. Like if we think that matter can either be produced or destroyed, like we can think about it in that way, but we can also think of it in terms of that if we lean into Freire's work, because it's an easy touch point, right? A lot of people are familiar with that we don't have a blank canvas that we're starting off with for learners in the space of education. But this is also very much out of African indigenous thinking around learning, is that in the collective, there's already knowledge that exists. And when the collective body comes together, there are ways of cultivating, nourishing that knowledge so that it comes out in ways that are much more poignant and that tell a fuller story, so on and so forth. So thinking through the reparative arts as a way to not just challenge, but to center the types of knowledge that come out of collective processes, that come out of embodied experiences, and that come out of a real desire by actual people to change their circumstances in ways that they have reason to value. Thinking about humans, all humans, regardless of their background, and I say, or their ethnic group, of their culture, of their race, as people who are reasonable, who can operate from a place of making decisions because they have sense making that occurs not just through what we're told makes sense, not just through what our academic canons say knowledge is, but sense making that comes through the body, that comes through our ancestry, and that comes through our being together. So preparative arts work on a few different levels of really thinking through what knowledge is, how knowledge is cultivated, and which knowledges have been subjugated and intentionally erased, and how much of that knowledge is embodied.
Dr. Blanks-Jones' work on reparative arts began long before she moved to Baltimore. Her background is as a music and theater educator.
Yes, in 2009, she founded Burning Barriers, Building Bridges Youth Theater, or B4 Youth Theater, in Liberia. The company/nonprofit engages youth in theater and the arts as a way to promote community health and wellness.
What I found very quickly in being in Liberia was that the use of theater for creating social cohesion, if we want to think about like international development language, or other types of bonds that are created through having a project-oriented mindset around what it means to be part of society. So leaning into my advisor, Dr. Segal Ben-Perat's work about having a project-based way of thinking about citizenship rather than an identity-based way of thinking about citizenship. Like, we are working towards something that we all will benefit from as a project, that we all have skin in the game, essentially, for a particular project to be seen through, like if democracy is that project, or if, well, whatever that project might be. But in societies where there are multiple identity groups, so we face that here in the U.S., right? Not if you ask, and I don't mean just because people are coming from different places in the contemporary moment, but if you ask a Black American what they feel about being an American, you might get a very different response from a white American based on the history of racism in the country. So to say that Americans have a shared identity can be a really fraught way of thinking about what it means to be a citizen of this place, if that's your entry point to thinking about citizenship. But if we're thinking about a project instead, and in a very tangible way, creating a theater production as a project, as a citizenship project, as a civic project where young people are learning how to be together despite their differences in Liberia, despite differences in ethnicity, differences in gender. There are ongoing problems around the treatment of girls in schools in particular, and that was one of the issues that the young people would always bring to the fore. That theater making was a very accepted way of working through problems.
As our conversation continued, Dr. Blanks-Jones went on to talk about how her work with B4 Youth Theater helped break open and challenge assumptions that are commonly held about the universality of certain embodied experiences and emotions.
Instance that I consider is from some of my own work in Liberia with my collaborator, Tara Carriazo of Waxing Moon Mask in Baltimore. She came over to Liberia with me about, 7 or 8 years ago. And we had worked on a curriculum coming out of Commedia dell'arte that she's studied for years. It's a physical theater pedagogy that she had been developing. And one of the assumptions that underlies that work is that there are certain emotions that are essentially universal in terms of where they can be felt, right? So if you ask an audience, most audiences, let's say in the U.S., how are people in general, when they think of joy and they're feeling joy, where in their body do they feel it? So for you, Ajane, where in your body do you feel joy? If I ask you to take in a deep breath and exhale joy, where are you feeling that joy?
Where do I feel joy? I think the first place that comes to mind is kind of in my chest. In a interesting way, which is interesting to me because that's also where I feel anxiety. But it's more of like a fullness here than it is like a tightness. Like it's kind of the opposite of that feeling. And I also, I don't know, I'm like, this is so cliche because I'm also a mover, but like in my feet. I'm like, that's the other place that's like kind of starting to like warm up, I guess you could say. But those are the two places for me.
No, that's great. And not cliche at all. Or I'm not going to go to you, but not because I'm not interested. I'm only because Ajahnay's response is generally what Tara and I have experienced in Western context. Is if you ask someone from the U.S., from Western Europe, where they experience joy, and to give us a movement that shows that arms become wide open, chest becomes open, and they feel it in their chest, in their heart, because that's where we are told we experience joy. I don't know. That's what we've been socialized to feel. When Tara brought this physical theater pedagogy over to Liberia and went through the same exercises of inhaling the emotion and sitting with the emotion and exhaling it with a gesture, our students, by and large, gave back movements that were in the feet. Not the chest.
That's arms, so funny.
The feet. Uh-huh. And Tara, someone who has studied this form for decades at this point, was like, oh, something here is different. This is not my training. This is not what I've been told is the thing. Emotion is located somewhere else in the body here. What is that about? And we can think about older anthropological research around, like, were the movement styles from Africa retained in the African diaspora population, yay or nay, you know, Herskovitz and friends or enemies, or, you know, however we want to think about that. but we can also just maybe be open to that there are some parts of culture that we're either socialized into that make our bodies respond in certain ways that cause us to sense certain things the way that we do. We can look at maybe Butler's work, you know, around gender to think about that as well. But there is maybe far less that's universal than has been assumed in a lot of movement work. And that really is my particular interest in the body and in the arts and how they work together and against each other, especially within collectives and how we're understanding what bodies do.
During the interview, Dr. Blanks-Jones shared numerous scholars and thinkers that she draws from in her scholarship. We were also curious about other storytellers or griots that inspire the multifaceted and dynamic work she does.
The first that comes to mind is Mama Janice Green with an E. There's a whole history there. Here in Baltimore, she is Maryland's griot for the state of Maryland, and she's been president of the Black Storytellers Association and other things like that. I met her, gosh, many, many years ago, and she's been just a close personal mentor and inspiration to me, and we now co-teach our Black Storytelling in Public Health course, Public Health in the Black World at Hopkins. We co-teach that, and that's a lot of fun. I'll also say Maba Shabu, that's Mama and Baba, rest in peace, Baba Shabu. In Liberia, they were born in the United States, and sometime in the, I want to say, 1960s, went to Africa and lived in different parts of the continent, learned a lot of things, and settled in Liberia, gave up their U.S. citizenship to become Liberians, and continue to make art there and to do a lot of work around land justice, climate justice, and to develop small circles of learning and sharing. So they're a constant inspiration. I talk to Mama almost every day. those are two of the griots that immediately come to mind. I will say also Baba Menace Yahuda here in Baltimore, who directs Urban Foley, Djembe Orchestra. He and his team, they did come to do the Ritual of Remembrance for us at Hopkins and helped inform a lot of my understanding of the connections between reparative arts and our African ancestral traditions. I think that's really important work.
This episode of Groove and Griot was a production of the Digital Futures Institute at Teachers College, Columbia University. It was produced and edited by me, Ajahnay Truss, and my co-host, Ara Badaki. Our theme music is Unrest by Elephant and can be found on directory.audio.
You can email us at groovinggrio@gmail.com. That's groovinggriot@gmail.com. And you can continue to listen to episodes of Groovin' Grio wherever podcasts are found. Thanks for grooving with us.